It's 2014, it's AZMcast, and we're talking about sedation and seekers. That's right, drugs and the people who love them. We've got a great set on tap for you guys today. We've got Chris Edwards talking to us about post-intubation sedation, and then just sedation in general. And then we've got Lisa Chan and Scott Lowry talking to us about what to do with the people that come in for that magical prescription with something, the drug that starts with a P, I can't remember, or that D drug, what was the, I can't remember, anyway, but you'll figure it out during this segment. We're going to see what ASAP's clinical policies has to say about it after the Choose Wisely campaign last month. I thought it'd be a good idea to try to correlate what our college has to say about these issues that we see every day. And then we're going to throw in a little bit more of the stuff that you and I both love so much, the practical documentation of all the beautiful healthcare that you provided, even though that patient may not have left with their dilaudid. That was the word, dilaudid! So at the end of the year, I was reviewing some of the stuff from the website that hosts this podcast, and I found out something very interesting. We have far more downloads than we have residents or faculty. I was pretty surprised by this. It's kind of nice, but I realized that there may be several people out there that don't know who Jared or I are, so we should probably introduce ourselves. So my name's Aaron Leach. I'm one of the assistant professors of emergency medicine and pediatrics at the University of Arizona, and I'm one of the associate program directors. Jared Mosier is an assistant professor of emergency medicine and internal medicine, and is an associate program director as well as a fellowship director for critical care. I have a focus of emergency medicine and pediatrics after doing a combined residency here at the U of A, and Jared has a focus of emergency and critical care after doing an emergency medicine residency and a critical care fellowship. So that's who we are. I'm glad that you guys like to listen. We're still planning on keeping this very local. We are going to have stuff that's directed at our residents, stuff that's directed at our hospital, inside jokes that if you would like to come here to Tucson, we can explain it to you. But we just wanted to make sure people knew who they were listening to. And for those of you that we know that had to just listen to me recite Jared and my CV, I'm very sorry. So this next segment that we have coming up is with myself, Jared Mosier, and with Chris Edwards, one of our ED pharmacists. We are blessed beyond belief to be able to have a pharmacist in our emergency department every day for a good chunk of the day when we really want a pharmacist checking our doses, grabbing medications, helping us not do stupid things like medication interactions that we would have otherwise had to look up on our own. So we're going to talk with Chris Edwards about post-intubation sedation, and then a little bit more about sedation in and of itself, namely procedural sedation in the emergency department. So we're going to sit down here. We've got myself, Jared, and Chris, our wonderful pharmacist, who offered to sit down with us and talk to us a bit about sedation. So Chris, you just intubated somebody. Can you tell me a little bit of the story of what happened without breaking any giant HIPAA laws?
Fair enough. I'll see what I can do. So we had a lady who came in. She was seizing after a possible hemorrhagic stroke. She had no gag reflex, needed to be intubated. We intubated her using etomidate and rocuronium. And then we initiated post-intubation sedation and analgesia immediately after the intubation attempt. We used fentanyl and propofol because she was hemodynamically stable prior to and after the intubation. And right now she seems to be doing fairly well with that.
So, Chris, how much concern was there over the seizures with rocuronium?
Not much. One of the concerns with using rocuronium in seizures is that you're going to mask the seizure activity, right? You won't be able to see any tonic-clonic movements, and the only way to know if the patient is still seizing is if you hook them up to an EEG. But her seizures seemed to stop prior to intubation, so we weren't too concerned about that, and we're going to have her on fairly aggressive doses of propofol to both make sure that she's sedated, to manage her blood pressure to a degree, and then also it should help with the seizure activity.
So how do you do the, when you do propofol post rocuronium? What I usually do is let's say I'm going to give etomidate and roc. I always tell the nurses to give a bolus of something about 5 minutes later, because you don't really know, they're going to be on 10 of propofol and they're going to look like they're fine, but you don't really know how much propofol they're going to need. What do you recommend?
Yeah, that's a great point. I usually recommend the same. Fairly aggressive bolus dose, as long as their blood pressure can handle it, and then starting to drip it around 20 mics per kilo per minute, just to make sure that they're adequately sedated while they while they're still paralyzed, because you're not really going to have any indicators of whether or not they're comfortable while the paralytic's on board.
So you and I have talked before about post-intubation sedation and analgesia here, and everybody is still on the Versed and fentanyl bandwagon when we know that propofol is better, that Versed lead, or any benzo leads to increased delirium, vent days, mortality, all that stuff down the road, but it hasn't really seemed to caught on downstairs to use propofol. And I think people are afraid of maybe the hypotension with it. And I've been trying to tell them, even if you have to use a couple mics of Levo to keep their blood pressure up while you use propofol, that's still better than using a benzo. What do you think?
Yeah, that's not unreasonable. The data's out there to suggest that non-benzodiazepine agents are better for long-term sedation, particularly in patients who are on mechanical ventilation and in the ICU. I think a short-term use of a benzodiazepine in an emergent setting is reasonable. One of the things that I'll sometimes recommend if we intubate using rocuronium and people are concerned about inducing hemodynamic instability with propofol is just giving one Versed bolus to get them through the rocuronium and then seeing what they look like after the rock is worn off, the dust is sort of settled a little bit, and then you can reassess at that point. It gives you some time to get some fluids on board, maybe even get a central line in place so that you can safely give vasopressors if necessary and counteract that effect.
I like that too. I usually, even if I'm going to do propofol, I'll give a dose of Versed if I've used rocuronium.
So I'm going to cut you off real quick because I'm still an intern attending, and you guys are talking way too fast and way too high level for me. So for all the other residents who are with me, so tell me a little bit more about Versed and fentanyl and what that affects downstream in the ICU, because these patients disappear. We don't see them again, but you do. So expound on that a little bit, just so we have a little basis to be able to say maybe Versed's not the best thing.
So most are all benzos, and the benzo that we use for post-intubation sedation is Versed. The reason we use Versed is because Ativan has propylene glycol in it, and you get liver failure, renal failure from that. So we use Versed. And the problem is that it increases your risk of delirium later in the ICU. And if you get ICU-acquired delirium, that leads to more vent days, more trachs, more ICU mortality. So we've tried to get rid of almost all benzos in the ICU. And what we do is we kind of go off the SCCM guidelines, which is you want to assess pain first. So the first drug that you use is fentanyl, and you use a lot of fentanyl, as much fentanyl as you need. And so typically what I do is I'll say, you know, start them at 100 of fentanyl. People down here tend to start at 25 or 50. It's not enough. Start at 100. And then after that, then the next recommendation is bolus doses of sedation if you need to. So boluses of Versed, boluses of propofol. In the emergency department, and then if you fail that, then you go on to a drip. And I don't know what you think, but in the emergency department, that's not the time to keep people awake in the emergency department. They're either intubated for profound shock, or they're altered, or they're combative, or we don't have the nurses that can stay one-to-one with them. That's not the time to keep them awake. So the first thing you should do is a bunch of fentanyl. The second thing you should do is a drip. Whether you want to do Versed or propofol, I would say if you can get by with propofol, do propofol. But if you have to use Versed, and we'll switch it later.
Now, would you say that's because of the quick on, quick off you get with propofol and the lack of metabolites that you store up?
Yeah, nobody's really sure what the mechanism is, because Precedex has been shown to be better than benzos, and it's a totally different mechanism, but I don't really recommend Precedex in the emergency department. That's a totally different discussion.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to that depth of sedation thing. It's the same reason why we want to start people on both analgesia and a drip right away. In addition to, you know, being a little bit understaffed, maybe not having the one-on-one patient-to-nurse ratio that we'd want to just do bolus dose sedation. I think down here we're doing all kinds of awful things to people, you know, putting in central lines, taking them over to CT, manipulating broken limbs, I would personally want to be very deeply sedated while all that stuff is going on. Once they get up to the ICU, they're laying in bed, they're comfortable, they've had their teeth brushed and all that good stuff. Then you can start lightening them up a little bit, waking them up, and you know, seeing if they'll fly without sedation.
Yeah, I agree.
But this is not the place to do it.
If you're in shock and you're intubated for shock, you don't want to have any intrinsic work of breathing. You need to be sedated.
Absolutely. So I'm going to take this back a little more basic still. So you've got your patient, you've intubated them, and just like you guys have recommended, give them a big slug of fentanyl. Start them on their propofol drip. Now, if the patient is sitting up in bed reaching for their tube, I think that's a patient that's probably not adequately sedated, and anybody can figure that one out. What are some of those more subtle signs you guys look at to say, let's turn the propofol up or let's turn the fentanyl up?
tachycardia, if they're crying, especially if they're on rocuronium and they start crying, then you know they need sedation. Their blood pressure starts to rise. If they're a patient in shock and you intubate them with rock and you've got the propofol at 10 or 20 per kilo and their blood pressure starts to go up and they get more tachycardic, that's not because their shock's worsening. It's because
they're
uncomfortable.
Yeah. So if they're uncomfortable, what do you reach for first? Do you give them more propofol because they're agitated, or do you give them more fentanyl because they're in pain with that tube in their glottis?
I turn the fentanyl up. What do you do?
Same here. I'll give a bolus of fentanyl and then turn the fentanyl up. And that's actually something that I see get messed up quite a bit. A lot of times nurses will just titrate up on the drips without giving boluses, and then they'll keep, you know, they'll have a patient who's reaching for their tube, so they'll go up to 50 on their propofol. And then a few minutes later, the patient's still kind of reaching for the tube, so they'll go up to 70. And then 10, 15 minutes later, all those adjustments start to catch up with the patient. They become hemodynamically unstable. They dump their pressure. Then the drip gets turned off. And then, you know, 30 minutes down the road, the patient's wide awake again. And it just sort of turns into this downward spiral of poor sedation. I think giving a little bit of a bolus every time you adjust the rate can really help to ensure that you're getting it dialed in a timely fashion and sort of avoid that whole scenario.
To throw in a Walterism, boluses get you there, drips keep you there.
Absolutely.
You and I have talked about trying to do a study where we're doing 300 or 400 mics of fentanyl and doing no sedation and see what that does. But, you know, it's not uncommon that we'll use 200, 250 mics of fentanyl.
And if you think about it, your big side effect that you're worried about with opiates is respiratory depression. If the patient has a tube in their airway, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
So I think you could be really aggressive with the fentanyl and not really run into too many problems.
So lots of great tips there from Jared and Chris. So just a quick summary of some of the things that they mentioned. Post-intubation care, remember you've got a paralytic and a sedative, and generally your sedative is going to wear off before your paralytic. So you want to be sure to have sedation as part of your RSI plan. It should be an induction agent, a paralytic, and then what are we going to sedate them on? I think that Chris makes a good point that if I were the one to be sedated, I would want to be well sedated. Another comment that they made is they prefer fentanyl and propofol to fentanyl and Versed if they need to. And the reason for that is that down the line, ICU delirium becomes a problem. Jared made an excellent point that it leads to more trachs, longer ICU stays, and we can avoid that in the ER by not starting them there. Chris makes a great point as well that if you have propofol on, you need fentanyl. And why is that? That's because propofol does not have any analgesic agents whatsoever. Propofol is an anesthetic and an amnestic. It is not an analgesic. Fentanyl, however, is. So look for those subtle signs that your patient is not adequately sedated, and instead of cranking the propofol up like you're the personal doctor of some pop star, turn up the fentanyl. Remember that they are probably in pain with that giant tube in their glottis. That single tear rolling down their cheek is probably because of a painful stimulus that you can easily address with some fentanyl. So that brings me to the next part that we're going to be discussing, which is sedation in general, specifically procedural sedation. So I guess not in general. To give you the end from the beginning, you want three things with a good sedation. You want amnesia, so that you forget the horrible things that we do to you under the sedation. You want analgesia, so that you don't feel the horrible things that we do to you under sedation. And you want anesthesia. You don't want to be aware of the horrible things we are doing to you under sedation. So amnesia, anesthesia, and analgesia are the three things we're looking for. And not all of the drugs that we have hit all those on their own.
So there's a few different things that you want from a good regimen. You want something that's going to provide anxiolysis, you want something that's going to provide analgesia, and you want something that's going to provide amnesia. And depending on what you're doing with the patient, you want something that's going to put them pretty deep as well. And unfortunately, there really isn't a perfect agent. So I think when you're selecting an agent, you need to think about not only the effects of that drug, but also the side effects of that drug, and see how it relates to your patient. So if you think about the agents that we have in our arsenal, you've got propofol, which is really good at putting people fairly deep, but it can cause some hypotension, and it doesn't give you any analgesia. You've got ketamine, which is awesome because it gives you both sedation and analgesia, as well as some amnesia, but it can cause tachycardia. You can run into some psychiatric effects as it's wearing off, and because of that, we don't really use it very often for the long term in ICU patients, so it's not a great agent for post-intubation sedation. And then you've got fentanyl, which gives you awesome analgesia, doesn't really give you much of an amnestic effect, and it can still have some effects on blood pressure. So those are really the agents that you have in your arsenal. And then I think you need to look at your patient and sort of think about the effects that drug is going to have and how you can use those agents to really get where you want to go. In addition, you've got the benzodiazepines, midazolam sort of being the representative one that we'll use for sometimes for post-intubation sedation analgesia. Don't use it much for procedural sedation because of the duration's a little bit long. You have to use a lot of it in order to get patients to a deep level of sedation. You can see as much hypotension with big bolus doses of Versed as you can with bolus doses of propofol. So not my favorite agent for procedural sedation, but something you can consider for post-intubation sedation analgesia.
And it's not that easy of a choice either. There's even when we talk about RSI, there's a couple case reports. We talk about doing RSI for somebody who's hypotensive and in septic shock with ketamine rather than etomidate. But there's case reports out there of people having cardiac arrests in after ketamine for RSI because their sympathomimetic receptors are all saturated and they get ketamine and have a cardiac arrest. So it's not always that easy.
Definitely. It's sometimes a very challenging choice. And I think you just need to think about what the situation is and try to pick the best regimen you can.
Some places that have a lot of money will have Precedex and Remifentanil available. And we've talked about this a lot before. And I think Precedex is not an emergency department drug for a couple reasons. One is we're not used to having somebody sedated but awake and following commands, and I think there's a risk of over-sedation with it.
Definitely.
And remifentanil, the thought behind remifentanil is that it's so rapidly acting that you get more sedative effect with it than fentanyl. And that might actually be a pretty good choice for somebody who's getting a procedural sedation.
Potentially, but I think if you dose them, if you dose your fentanyl sort of equal to the doses that were used with remifentanil in some of the studies, you'd get similar effects. I think we underdose fentanyl and could potentially get there with bigger doses.
So great job going over our classes of drugs and all of our options that we have available, but big deal, we can look those up on a formulary, right? Let's ask Chris and Jared about some cases. What would they use in real life?
I'm going to throw out some cases and tell me what you guys think. What would be your selection for more of a procedural sedation? So you've got a 18-year-old motorcycle crash who's got an open femur fracture, and the guy is not tolerating anything. His thigh is clamped down because his muscles are spasming, and you need to pull him out to length and get that sucker set. And ortho says, I'm not touching him until you give him some sedation. What are you guys going to use?
What's his blood pressure?
His blood pressure, we'll say, is 160 over 90.
Perfect. So he's hemodynamically stable. He'd be able to tolerate a slug of propofol. That's really the best choice in the situation because not only is it going to give you the depth of sedation that you need, but also the muscle relaxation to pull against that big muscle group and get that thing set. So I would do propofol. I would also probably add some fentanyl because propofol is not going to give you any analgesia. And by giving a good-sized dose of fentanyl prior to the procedure, it'll allow you to use less propofol and the patient will experience less discomfort. So.
Yeah, what I do for all these long duration ones, like hip reductions and whatnot, that are going to take a while. So I use fentanyl as well. I use a bunch of fentanyl. And then if it's going to be like a 20-minute procedure, I'll give them just one dose of ketamine. And then for the parts where they need to be deeper, I'll bolus some propofol.
Yeah, that's actually an awesome point. So I get asked pretty frequently about ketofol. And in the studies, they did ketofol using 0.5 mg/kg of ketamine and 0.5 mg/kg of propofol, mixing them in the same syringe and giving it as basically one agent. But when I use the combination, I usually do the same thing. I'll give like 1 mg/kg of ketamine, get them fully dissociated. And then if you need them a little bit deeper or a little bit more relaxed, I'll use a little bit of propofol just to get that depth of sedation.
There's just more finesse that way. It's cleaner.
I think so. And having them in separate syringes allows you to give whichever agent you want.
Yeah.
So if they become a little bit hypotensive and maybe need to go a bit deeper, you can give them a slug of ketamine. If they need that relaxation, you can give them a bolus of propofol. So
I'll tell you, I am a ketamaniac. I love ketamine. For ketamine, it's got one of the things the nurses hate about is that it takes a long time to wear off and you got to watch them. Everybody worries about bad dreams and emergency reactions. What I tell the parents is we're going to put your kid to sleep in the most truest sense of that word. They are going to be asleep and they're going to be sleepwalking, really. They will respond. They won't actually be able to remember it. And when they wake up, sometimes they wake up from a good dream, sometimes they wake up from a bad dream. Now when it's an adult, I say sometimes they wake up from a good trip, sometimes they wake up from a bad trip. Hans Bradshaw one time was watching this guy and he was freaking out and Hans goes, dude, calm down, bro, you're going to have a bad trip. Hans was right, dude had a bad trip. So I like ketamine a lot for something that's going to take a while and I'm not sure if they're going to, you know, how much sedation they're going to need overall. But for something like that, I probably would just grab for the ketamine as long as I was sure that the patient was, in a happy place.
And that's key. Even in adult patients, if we use ketamine as a lone agent, I usually talk to the patient and say, look, you're going to have some vivid dreams with this drug that we're giving you. Try to think of something happy. You know, what's a great trip that you just took, or what's your favorite place to be? Start thinking about that. And then get the patient in a positive mental state before you push the drug. And then they sort of remain in that state as that emergence phase is going on. And I've had really good success with that sort of is putting them in a positive mental state before knocking them out.
The one thing I'll highlight for kids, and granted that was an 18-year-old, but for kids chew up propofol. So I have gone away from using propofol almost entirely for kids, because what ends up happening, and what I fear with the ortho procedures too, is you're pushing on them and the patient's reacting. They say, give them more propofol. Push on them, patient's reacting, give them more propofol. Put them down, put them under. By the time you bolus them multiple times, they get their bone back into place, their painful stimulus is gone, and all that propofol has nowhere to go except to cause respiratory depression and hypotension. That's been my experience. Have you guys had that experience, especially with orthopedic procedures?
Yeah, hip reductions are the worst about that. You have to get them so deep to get their muscles to relax, and then after the pain stimulus is gone, you're bagging them for 5 minutes. It's painful. Do you do IM ketamine?
I will not do IM ketamine, and I'll tell you why.
I won't either.
I'll tell people out of it.
Yeah. I'll tell you why. It's because I've had one bad experience with ketamine where my IV infiltrated, and the kid got the majority of the dose sub-Q, and that was a bad trip. Very, very slow onset. And then, hey, they're under. Let's do our procedure. Very slow offset. That kid was puking. That kid was tripping. That kid had a really, really bad time. So for that reason, I don't use IM ketamine unless it is a crash intubation. Really, IM ketamine is not. I'm not a big fan.
Yeah, I hate it. I've had nothing good happen from IM ketamine. Either it's a terrible sedation, it's dirty, or somebody has a laryngospasm, and then all of a sudden you need to intervene, and you've got no IV access.
Yeah,
I know we all hate watching kids squirm, but it's just dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. It's completely dangerous, and the pharmacokinetics of it are really not conducive to procedural sedation. It takes 10 to 15 minutes to kick in. It sticks around for, books say 30 to 60 minutes, but I've seen it last for hours, where the kid remains fairly high for extended periods of time. And it's just not good. Not something I would recommend.
The one thing I do really love about ketamine that I was going to mention is that it has a very obvious on and off.
Mm-hmm.
Those twitching eyes, that glazed over stare, you know when it's working, and you can convince parents, loved ones, whoever else is going to be in the room if you're having them there, that this is how we know it's working. The parents see it, it registers with them, and you say, they're out, they're not remembering. And most parents will tolerate that a whole lot better than the kid who wakes up a little bit with the propofol, wakes up a little bit with the fentanyl Versed.
Is your standard procedure with ketamine to use glycopyrrolate?
No, it's not actually. I haven't had a whole lot of bronchorrhea with these. Usually I've found when I have had issues, it's been with longer sedations where we've had to redose the ketamine twice, three times. Then I start to see a lot more of the bronchorrhea. But I haven't routinely done it, but I've had it in the room to give it if I need to.
What do you guys do?
That's usually what I'll do. I'll have it in my pocket. Excuse me. I'll have it in my pocket, ready to go. But I've only used it a handful of times. And generally, it's if bronchorrhea or lacrimation really becomes an issue, either for airway stuff or if the family is concerned that the patient's crying a lot, we'll just give them a little slug of early and go.
I use it routinely if I'm messing around with the airway. If it's just a procedural sedation for something else, I don't. But if I'm messing around with the airway, I do.
Let me give you another case. So we've got a 40-year-old comes in. He's in AFib. He has an onset that he knows. And he's very well versed in literature and has gone to his cardiologist multiple times and been buzzed out of it. So he comes in. He says, I want to be shocked, but I don't want to remember this. You're going to put him down when you try to cardiovert him out of his AFib? We'll assume that all other circumstances are great, and we're not going to argue about rapid Ottawa protocol.
What's his blood pressure?
Blood pressure is pristine. It is, we'll say that it's 120 over 81.
All right, I like the sound of that. I'd go propofol again. I used to recommend a lot of Etomidate for cardioversion, but the problem that I've run into is about 40% of patients who get Etomidate, even at the procedural sedation doses of 0.1 mg per kilo, you can still see about 40% of patients get myoclonus. And that's problematic. Let's say you give somebody Etomidate, you put them down, then you cardiovert them, give them this big dose of electricity, and then they start getting myoclonus. First thing people think is, oh my God, we gave this guy a seizure. Go get some Ativan. And I'm like, no, it's just the Etomidate. Oh, I don't care. Let's give him some Ativan anyway. Okay. So in addition to
foolish
the,
doctors.
you know, in addition to the sort of seizure-like activity, it also makes it really difficult to get your follow-up EKG. So you don't know for 5 minutes if the cardioversion worked. So I've sort of fallen out of love with Atomitate for cardioversion, but it's still a reasonable option. With the blood pressure, you know, sitting pretty at 120 over 80, I would feel totally comfortable doing propofol for that.
Yeah, I think Atomitate without a paralytic is like just having a peanut butter sandwich without jelly. I hate it.
It's just not the same.
I would use propofol. I would even use propofol if the person was hypotensive. Yeah. That would just give a little bolus dose of fentanyl. You're assuming the blood pressure is going to get better after the cardioversion, so I like propofol. All right, so let's say we have one more case. Let's give you the 2-year-old who comes in, had a head bonk, is puking, but is otherwise following commands. You go, this kid needs a scan. It's not a painful procedure, but we need this kid to sit still. And this is a kid who's also got a good pressure. This is a kid who is mentating, but just, you're worried, I got to scan this kid. I'm worried about the mechanism. What are you going to do to sedate a kid that has, for a non-painful procedure, that they need to sit still with?
Boy, that's a tough one. You know, ketamine is sort of the first thing that comes to mind, but he bonked his head, so there's a concern about increasing the intracranial pressure. Now, evidence doesn't really support that. There are some studies, one in particular that came out a few years ago out of Israel, that say that ketamine actually reduces intracranial pressure. The initial evidence with ketamine increasing intracranial pressure came from bolted rats. The evidence doesn't support the fact that ketamine increases intracranial pressure. That being said, every textbook says that it does. So if something bad happens with that kid, he has a bad neurologic outcome, somebody decides to sue, you're not really going to have a leg to stand on. So I would probably avoid ketamine in that situation, even though it's probably a good agent to use there. I would probably go with a benzo. I'd probably do a little Versed. Just anxiolysis, try to get him to chill out a little bit so that they'll sit still for the procedure. But that's a tough situation.
Yeah, those studies about ketamine and ICP, it was 3 studies. I think they were case series, actually, in a total of 13 patients. And every one of them had chronic outflow obstructions from tumors and whatnot. So if you don't have an outflow obstruction, you really don't have to worry about it. That being said, in this case, I would probably give a little Benadryl, and if that didn't work, I'd call one of you two.
I'm a big fan of Brutane, of get in there, hold the kid down. The CT techs hate it because they don't like to hold kids down. But, man, if you can get some distraction and some Brutane, that I like to avoid sedation when I can on these kids. If it's close to nap time, rush them over there with their nap. And those CT techs love when the kid is asleep because they hate when the kid's awake. So if you call them, I got a kid that needs a scan and they're asleep, bring them right over. We're ready. We're ready. There's a stroke and there's a guy who was shot in the head, but we're going to push him off to the side because I don't want to have to deal with this kid. In all fairness, they're really good about this and they've helped me out a ton. But if that doesn't work, I've tried Benadryl. I haven't had good luck. The thing you don't want to have is the paradoxical reaction to the Benadryl of now the kid's bouncing off the walls and you go, well, crap, now what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. So this is where I've had really good luck with intranasal Versed. The thing that sucks about intranasal Versed is it burns. It burns like crazy. But it gets the kid just loopy enough to where you can get some Coban around the head, pack some towels and some sheets along the side, wrap them real tight in that big Velcro wrap, throw in a little SpongeBob, and they are good to go. The last one I did with this, the nurse just had to put her finger on the kid's chin so that the kid wouldn't move his head. We were good. We were golden. We got everything done without any trouble.
Yeah, the trick with intranasal Versed is just making sure that it's dosed appropriately and also making sure that the nurse grabs the right concentration. So we've got a couple of different concentrations of Versed available. Well, one of them is 1 mg/mL. One of them is 5 mg/mL. And you want to use the more concentrated one for the intranasal so that you're given much less volume in the nares. Also making sure that the kid's nose isn't full of boogers helps as well.
Yeah, which is hard to do this time of year.
Yeah.
So let's say you have a 60-year-old lady. She comes in because she fell and dislocated her shoulder. It's been out for 12 hours now. You know this is going to be a rough one. And when you look, she's got a history of COPD. She's got a history of CABG, 4-vessel. She's on beta blockers. She's on calcium channel blockers. Her pressure is a little tenuous because she just had her meds adjusted, and it's 90 over 62. So now what are we going to choose to sedate this lady?
That's a fun one. So I would want to get some fluids on board, see if we can get that pressure a little bit better before doing anything. And then I'd probably do that ketamine-propofol combination that Jared and I were talking about earlier. I'd probably give her like 1 mg/kg of ketamine up front and then 0.5 mg/kg boluses of propofol in order to get the depth of sedation. And I'd keep my fingers crossed because it doesn't sound like you're probably going to get that back in.
Yeah,
I would maybe try the Sierra Born method of rubbing her back and saying nice things to her and see if that works, or whatever that method's called. I mean, if that didn't work, I would
the
do
Born
that.
Method.
Yeah.
So that was a case I had in residency that got signed out to me. Oh yeah, yeah. She just needs to be sedated and have her shoulder, or she needs post production films. Yeah.
Nice.
Did you feel it go in? Well, just check for post production films. Thanks a lot. I can't remember who it is, so I can't blame them on the podcast. But
there are some sedations that we probably shouldn't do. Yeah. There's super high-risk ones like that.
Yeah.
Just,
so we tried. We tried to do it. My attending and I tried, and we made her quite apneic. We bagged her for probably about 5 minutes. She eventually started breathing again, and we called ortho and said, you got to take her to the OR to get this out. We're not doing it. And so the ortho resident comes to see her, and then says, yeah, I got her set up. We're just kind of waiting for her shoulder to go back in. I go, what'd you do? He goes, oh, I just put one of the meal trays from the cafeteria under her axilla, and I took 5-liter bottles of saline and tied them to her wrist. You did what? About 10 minutes later, you hear crack all the way down the hall, and her shoulder was back in place.
Oh.
She just needed quite a bit of manual traction. He knew he didn't want to take her to the OR either. That was going to be rough on him. It was going to be a bad sedation for everybody. Sometimes not sedating and trying to find another method is the best decision. And she did fine with it. When it went back in, that hurt. We gave her some fentanyl, and then she was totally fine. So when they got a lot of risk factors, sometimes trying to think outside the box is
Yeah, this may
helpful.
Be where all yeah. the scalene blocks and stuff that these guys are doing might be helpful.
Absolutely.
If you take the ultrasound probe and just hit them really hard with it.
So switching gears ever so slightly, we're going to start talking about controlled substances and the people who come into the emergency department requesting them. And what we're going to do is go directly to the source, the people that back us when we get in trouble, ACEP, the American College of Emergency Physicians, who has in 2002 published a guidelines for critical issues in the prescribing of opioids for adult patients in the emergency department. This was published in June of 2014 and highlights some of the major problems that we've been having since the late 90s. Did you know deaths attributed to opioid overdose has more than tripled between the years of 1999 and 2008? Did you also know that drug overdose is the second leading cause of injury death in the United States, right behind motor vehicle collisions? Did you further know that prescribers write for enough opioid medication for every American adult to have 5 milligrams of oxycodone every 4 hours for a month? Of course you guys know this. You may not know the actual numbers, but you know that this is a problem. You know that this is a problem on every shift. You know that this is maybe more of a problem on the night shift. And you walk into your shift going, what am I going to do today? Well, good news that the college has actually backed us, recognized that this is an issue, and put out some guidelines so that we have a little bit of force behind telling our patients that opioid medication might not be the best choice for you at this time. For starters, the position statement makes a very clear delineation between cancer pain and non-cancer pain. And the people that we're talking about right now are people that do not have cancer-related pain. The first recommendation they make is they do recommend using state prescription monitoring databases, so like our AZ Pharmacy database that we can look up and see how many people have gotten how many prescriptions from how many providers. That's something that has a level C recommendation, meaning there's no evidence, but sure sounds like a good idea. Their second recommendation is in low back pain, especially acute low back pain, try non-narcotics first and reserve narcotic pain medication for refractory low back pain. This is something we see pretty often, and I personally haven't had much success in getting people feeling better in the ED, but definitely worth a try. They also, on their third recommendation, say that there's no literature to support Schedule 2 narcotics, i.e. oxycodone, over Schedule 3 narcotics, i.e. hydrocodone. So no evidence to say that Percocet really works better than Vicodin. The next recommendation is to avoid routine outpatient opioids for acute exacerbations of chronic pain, as the benefits are outweighed by the risk. But if we do decide to prescribe outpatient opioids, we should do so at the lowest practical dose for a limited duration. And their example they give is 1 week's worth. We should also do our best to honor existing patient pain contracts with their primary providers. This may not sound like much, but it's definitely a step in the right direction toward backing up what we're able to do in the emergency department. So what do we do in our emergency department? Well, we're going to talk with Dr. Lisa Chan, who devised our emergency department opioid policy, and get her opinion on not only how the policy works, but also some good examples on how to enforce it. So Lisa, I'm a 31-year-old male who's coming into RME, and wouldn't you know it, my backpack got stolen on the bus, and all of my 4-milligram dilaudid pills and my long-acting oxycodone, they're all gone. And man, I've been in really bad opiate withdrawal before, and all I need is just something, anything at all. What are you going to do for me?
So I'm going to explain to the patient that our policy doesn't allow us to do refills for opioid medication. Explain to the patient the dangers of using opioids, the addiction, and all the complications that go along with it, and that he needs to follow up with his own physician to obtain the medications. And also, I would offer to him, if he wants to have information, contact information for detox or rehab, to try to help him get him off the medications.
So I'm going to give you some of the most common buts that I get when I try to give that argument back. So the first one is, but I don't have a primary care physician.
I'll offer them a silver ticket and also give them contact information for Kodak or Compass. Offer them that they can speak with our social worker.
One of the other ones I get is, well, can I just have something here till I can get in touch with my primary doctor?
And I'll remind them again that our policy says that we cannot treat opioids with chronic pain, and it's the wrong care for them because I don't want to continue their problem of addiction.
And that leads me to the most common one, which is, but I don't have a drug problem. These are all prescribed to me, and these are for my health.
So then you need to follow up with the person who prescribed these medicines, and the fact that you've been on all the medications for a long period of time tells me that likely there is some degree of dependency that you really need to address, and that's what's best for your health.
But what about my pain?
That creepy voice right there is Jared Mosier, who wasn't actually invited to this recording, but came in to try to score some oxy.
The reason probably why you're having pain is because you are on these opioids, because what opioids does is it upregulates your receptors. And so the more opioids that you take, you change your receptors, so even things that don't cause pain will cause pain. So likely what's causing you to have pain is that you are on these opioids. So if I gave you more, that would actually make your pain worse.
The last one I usually get is, so why do you hate me so much? No. So you haven't had that one yet. This is rarely a easy conversation to have with a patient, but this is something that we, I think, as emergency doctors are quite responsible for, along with primary care physicians. We bear a lot of the responsibility. How good do you think we're doing with this now that there seems to be a new realization that this is such an epidemic?
I still think that we can do a lot better than what we're doing now. I think that most people, not just ED physicians, but any service, whether it be physicians or non-physicians, whether it be inpatient or outpatient, really don't like confrontation. And so the, quote, easiest things for them to do is just to give the opioids. And they'll try to justify it by saying, oh, this patient might be in pain. I'll just give him one dose. He'll follow up. But I think the bottom line is that we don't like to confront.
I think I heard somewhere or read on ASAP News or something like that recently that narcotic overdose has overtaken trauma, excuse me, as the number one cause of death in the United States.
If that's truly the case, then we have not been doing a great job since that ASAP policy came out 2 years ago.
What do you think is the cause of that? And do you think that we tend to prescribe narcotics because of all the patient satisfaction parameters that are put on our constraints that are put on us?
I actually think the patient satisfaction is one excuse that doctors will use to justify them giving the medicine. I don't think that they necessarily believe that. I did a retrospective study that showed that patients who got more opioids actually did not give higher scores on the patient satisfaction. So there hasn't been any correlation from that. But I think that physicians may or may not believe in that, but they'll use that as a justification to give the medicine because they don't like the confrontation.
I was going to go into the buts that doctors usually give of but I don't want to confront the patient, but it's not my problem. But what about my patient satisfaction scores? And I think that you pretty appropriately hit all of those in that, you know, this is a problem. And it's the same as talking with a patient about alcoholism or anything else that would bring them in, that we need to have a discussion that this is a problem. And, you know, if we can't fix them here, we certainly don't want to contribute to it. So,
and I think the other huge part of it that's hard is that I think it's also very much societal. And opioids are somewhat like alcohol. There's a lot of alcohol intoxication that causes death and societal problems. But overall, I think society has accepted alcohol. And I think the same thing is happening with the opioids.
Lisa, what do you think about the opposite situation where people with real disease or real problems come in and they get treated by the cynical nurse or the cynical physician who thinks that everybody's just a drug seeker?
Yeah, I think there's a combination of things going on there. I think when somebody comes in, whether or not they're opioid naive or not, you have to make sure that they don't have an acute medical condition. And so you need to still do the workup if you think that there's any question that there's a medical problem. And so some people say, well, I want to give the patient the benefit of the doubt and give them opioids. And if you think that there truly is a chance that they're in pain, then you give it. But your benefit, you giving them the benefit of the doubt is that you're doing a workup. Because really the main thing when it comes to ED is that you're doing a workup to make sure there's no medical condition. And then sometimes you have both, right? You have a patient who has a medical condition but also has something that is causing acute pain. So say, for instance, somebody who's a drug seeker but actually is hit by a car, not actually has a fracture. So you need to treat that pain. And in those situations, you have to, I think, a lot of times go to different medication like ketamine. And the other problem with opioids is that in these patients who are so dependent on opioids, when they come in and they actually really do have a true condition that causes pain, it's really, really hard to control their pain because now their receptors have been so upregulated by us. Now it really is hard to control that pain, which is another problem of giving opioids freely.
The drug database may help sort some of that out too. As Mark Wright points out, if you've got 30 different prescriptions from 50 different doctors, you know, you probably are more likely to be a drug seeker.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing to use, even though the database, a lot of times it's negative and it's falsely negative, and also there's a lag from the time that the patient fills the prescription to the time that it enters the database. It's not a great website that's user-friendly. It's somewhat a little bit hard to use. And the reason why that is because the people who actually control that database are the drug companies. So they purposely make it hard to use that database. But when it shows stuff, then it really, really is helpful. And you should always use that database to look if you're not sure.
Have you noticed that when you look in the database and you get these egregious numbers like 300 OxyContin or whatever, that it's more than likely prescribed by a mid-level provider?
Yeah, I found that also.
Interesting.
Lots of scandal there. I'm just going to ask you a couple of questions about the drug database that I have heard, and I was hoping you could try to rectify some of these things. So one thing I've heard is that we are not allowed to give a copy of the drug database to the patient. And another thing I've heard is that we are not allowed to cite the drug database in the medical record.
I haven't heard that you can't give a copy to the patient. And it's part of the patient's... It's information that you're using to help treat the patient. So I wouldn't see why you couldn't put it into the medical record, because that's, you know, like using a previous CT scan to make your decision. You know, whenever we see a patient, we use as much information as we can. That's where we look at previous notes, previous CAT scans, previous EKGs to compare to. And this is also one piece of information. Because if drug seeking is on your differential, you need something to help rule it in or rule it out.
It's exhausting to fight this fight. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest. There are some times where I'm just burnt out at the end of my shift and just think, all right, screw it, whatever. Give them some Dilaudid.
Yeah, and I know it's hard because these people really know how to do that, and they purposely do that. And especially, like you said, when you're really tired and it's been a rough shift. But I know for myself that if I argue with the patient, it's a lose-lose situation, because if you argue with the patient, you go home and, you know, it's not fun arguing with the patient.
That phone call was Walgreens asking Lisa to verify a prescription for 1 kilo of morphine, spelled M-O-F-E-E-N. Lisa, of course, declined.
So you lose that weight. But I know that I have a feeling of a bigger loss when I've given in, because I know I've done the wrong thing for the patient. So I just keep thinking that you know, if I say yes now, when I go home, I'm going to feel even worse, because I know deep down that I did the wrong thing for that patient.
Jeremy Racy tells a story about when he was at Northwest and he had a patient that came in with migraines and says, I always get these migraines and the only thing that helps me is Ativan and fentanyl. And he refused to give her Ativan and fentanyl. She filed the complaint with the hospital, and he had to reimburse her the fee for his visit.
Yeah, and I think that that hospital admin for a time period had been that way, that you have to, no matter what the patient wanted, that you needed to please the patient. But I think now with more information coming out of the problem opioid seeking and the problems that's causing, that hospital administration are actually turning that around a bit. There's a couple of hospitals who used to be like that, and I know now they actually have drug-seeking policies.
So thanks to Lisa for kind of covering some of those scenarios. Who are these other hospitals that have these drug-seeking policies, and what kind of a person would be so bold as to step up and make these? Our own Scott Lowry.
Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Aaron.
How you doing?
Good.
Can I have some Percocet?
No.
Oh, okay. So Scott Lowry is responsible for two of the other major medical systems' narcotics plans that they use, both at Tucson Medical Center and the Carondelet system. You want to tell people a little bit about what the rules that you devised over there were and kind of how you came about them?
Sure. So technically I stole the program from Scottsdale about 6 years ago, 7 years ago. One of the guys came down from Scottsdale and gave us a lecture when I was a resident at our Tuesday morning conference, and laid out their whole plan of what they do with drug seekers, and offered anybody who was interested basically all of their information on it. So I contacted them afterwards, because I knew I was headed off to TMC where they did not have a policy, and I got all their paperwork, all their policies, all the documents that they use at Scottsdale, and modified it for Tucson and for TMC. It took quite a while to implement it. It took maybe a little over a year and a half. Most of it was getting the resources involved and in place, mostly case management, social work. Social work pretty much ran the show for us after I got all the documentation passed through our legal department at TMC. And then when I left TMC after we got this going, one of the social workers who was under her, who took it on after her, took it over with us to Carondelet and is now in charge of social work at St. Mary's. So she started at St. Mary's first, and then Joe's adopted it from there.
So if you could lay out just a little brief description of what it is, what's kind of the policy that you've set up?
Sure. It's basically works off of a three-strike rule. So first, it's all based off of physician interpretation and judgment. So the physician has to first decide that the visit today that they're seeing the patient for is strictly for drug-seeking behavior and not a legitimate medical reason aside from narcotic seeking, and withdrawal is accounted for in there. So it's up to their discretion on flagging the patient's visit for that particular visit. So once they decide this is an inappropriate use of the medical system, then they approach social work and say, I want to flag this patient for the drug program. Now the drug program is worded and stated for the patient's safety. It's not because you're here abusing the system and we want you the heck out of our department and I'm not giving you any candy, because that's not what I'm going to do. The whole thing is geared towards, this is for your safety. About 2 or 3 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, the death rate in the United States from prescription opiates surpassed the deaths of car accidents in our country.
All right, fine, opiates. You win. You always do.
Which is great if you're, you know, highway patrol, but not so much for physicians. So using that as our backing, that's how we got through all of our legal issues with the hospitals, saying we don't want to give these people narcs and we need help getting them the right resources so they're not coming to the emergency department for it. So part of being flagged is you got a letter from the hospital to you as the patient and to your primary care physician. If you didn't have a primary care, we helped set you up with a primary care and sent them a letter. And we have helped get them the appropriate pain management resources. We were in contact with a couple of the pain clinics around town and had deals with them to see our patients. And they agreed as long as they had a primary care, which we helped arrange for them as well. Similar to kind of your golden ticket, golden silver tickets that we have here now.
Very cool.
A lot of these patients that we see come in, these are things that we've kind of created. These are addictions that you could argue that we've created by throwing narcs at people. And I know that in the emergency department, we're often blamed. This is definitely a primary care issue as well. How much of an impact did you see this have after you implemented it both at TMC and at Joe's and Mary's?
Phenomenal impact on the number of visits that came through. It was actually quite impressive. The first couple months, we didn't really see much of a change at all, and it just really seemed like a pain in the ass to do it because it was difficult in the end to have the conversation with the patient and say, you know, you're getting set up for this program that we have called a chronic pain program. We didn't call it drug seeker program or anything. Our chronic pain program that we're going to get you help and get it for your safety. And you had to keep saying for your safety. But after about 6 months, the visit numbers from these patients really dropped off dramatically. And we saw the same thing at Mary's and Joe's. And it took, again, there about 6 months before we really saw a significant decline. And the numbers were staggering. I don't remember them off the top of my head now, but it went from, if it was 100% of how many we saw, it dropped down to below 20% of what it was.
Wow.
So it was cut by those patients by more than down to a fifth of what they were doing.
Wow.
And what was the physician compliance like? Did you get everybody to buy into this, or did you have people that said, no, you don't get to tell me how to practice?
So that was the hardest part to get it started, aside from the social work getting involved. And it's the only way for the program to work. So we basically had all these meetings with the physicians saying, this is not going to work unless we're 100% consistent. Consistency is the backbone for this program. If you don't have every provider on board, it does not work. So it took a while, and there were a couple that were saying, oh, well, you don't know what it's like at night, or it's just easier to give them the drugs and I don't have to deal with this patient anymore. But then we had to show them the statistics. Like at Joe's and Mary's, there were more providers that we had to deal with. So we showed them the statistics that we had from TMC that after 6 months, yes, it's a pain in the ass for 6 months, but you got to stick it out, and then you're really going to see the benefits, and we did.
Now, is this for patients that were asking for prescriptions or patients that wanted IV narcotics or both?
Combination. So it's technically for both, and both are affected by the program. So I was kind of saying that the first time you flag them, they go into the system, they get the letters, and then they're discharged with up to a prescription for up to, I believe it's 12 or 20. I think it was 12. Actually, I think it was 20, but I always get 12. 20 Vicodin, and that was the only thing they were allowed to go home with as far as narcs. The second visit, when you say, you know, this is another visit, I think is just for pain-seeking behavior, and you look them up, and they've already gotten the first letter, so now it's their second visit that you're flagging. Then they get the letter saying this is your second letter, etc. It goes to them and to their physicians again. Social work talks with them again in the room before they're discharged, and they can be discharged with the same prescription of Vicodin up to 20, and you can give them whatever IV you felt was necessary at that time. And the third visit, when they're flagged for their third strike, they can only get 2 Vicodin in the department. They cannot get any IV narcotics, and they don't get any prescriptions to go home. And every visit there on after is the same as the third. And it shows this is your, you know, 12th letter that you've received. This is demonstrating that you are abusing the system.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's worded as for your safety. We're not giving you opiate narcotics.
Yeah, I think that's important to try to highlight as for your safety. Did you find that patients were receptive to that, if this is an epidemic in our country, this is something we have control over and we're doing this for your good, even though it may not seem like it?
A big mixed bag. Some patients actually said thank you. Many more said thank you than I thought they would. And of course, you had the people that just got up and walked out. But when they just get up and walk out without any argument for, but I'm in pain, they just say, oh, walk out.
Yeah.
Have a nice day.
I guess that's easy to take care of as well.
It's pretty easy to take care of.
Interesting. You know, the thing that I always have the hard time with, I don't have any trouble saying, hey, your workup was normal. Looking through the pharmacy database, you've had, you know, a prescription for 240 Percocet filled yesterday. I don't think you need any more Narcs to go home with. I have a hard time when you first evaluate the patient saying, I don't know, are you legit? Are you not? Even some of our patients that we see on a daily basis that we just know, but you have real disease. Do you have any personal advice or tips or anything to try to help ferret that out, or do you just treat everybody when they come in and sort it out later?
It's tough. The flagging them for the first time, it was the hardest part of the program for setting it off. When you've seen they've been here 12 times and they've gotten 6 letters, it's easy enough to say, you know what, your labs are normal again, you're here again for the same thing, you're clearly getting these letters, you know, the next letter is easy to do. The first one can be tough. Especially some of these people who do have true medical issues and just are either a victim of circumstance from their own diseases that we keep treating with narcotics, so now they can't get off the narcotics and maybe can't separate their disease from their addiction. Those are really tough. So you can have conversations with your patients which don't always go well. Sometimes they do, but most patients that you really want to flag don't go well. The first time is tough.
That call was actually Lisa trying to ask Scott why she had forged a prescription in her name for 1 kilo of morphine. Well, thanks to Lisa and to Scott for talking to us about prescription narcotic abuse, prescription narcotic epidemic. Those of you that are keeping track, I've said epidemic about 57 times during this podcast. Hopefully that drives a point home. But one of the things that you don't want to hear as that patient is leaving is the 4 words that you can blow off for the night but will haunt you for the rest of the week. I'm going to sue. Can they sue? Can they really get away with that? I asked some of our risk management people to weigh in on this and to weigh in on the best way to document our interactions with people that we decide not to give narcotic pain medicine to. So we're lucky enough to be able to meet with 2 of our risk management specialists. We have Gloria DeLauder and Jackie Commercy, who are going to be talking with us about how we deal with the documentation issues, not so much like we've discussed before of getting paid for it, but how to make sure that we document ourselves appropriately of what we did so that if anything were to happen, we actually have it down on paper exactly what happened in a way that is truthful, in a way that is complete and concise is usually helpful as well. So I'm going to let Gloria and Jackie introduce themselves and kind of a quick synopsis of how they got to where they're at.
Hi, I'm Gloria DeLauder. I'm a registered nurse. I have been a nurse for over 35 years, 23 of which have been with the corporation, and I've been in legal risk for over 8 years.
And I'm Jackie Commercy. I'm also a nurse. My background is primarily in legal nurse consulting. I have 20 years experience in that area. I'm new to University of Arizona Health Network. I've been here about 7 months.
Great. Well, welcome to both of you, and thank you so much for helping us out with this. This is one of those lingering things that happens at the end of your shift when you drive home and you say, man, I really hope I handled that correctly. I know as an intern attending, only been practicing about 6 months, I have called you guys at least twice already, just trying to figure out exactly the right way to go. So the first question I have is, have you ever seen a lawsuit either sent to you guys or actually gone to trial or won for someone that was refused pain medicine and sued the hospital or sued the provider?
I have never seen a lawsuit filed with that complaint. However, I have seen a civil rights complaint that a patient filed with the Civil Rights Commission regarding that issue. In those instances, what we have to do then is investigate it and respond to the Civil Rights Commission as to the rationale, exactly what happened. But no, I've never seen a lawsuit.
By civil rights, you mean it wasn't so much that the patient was denied medications, but it was more of a ethnic gender issue, or how?
No, they were saying that their civil rights were violated because of the physician's refusal to treat their disease process, i.e. with pain medications.
Okay.
I've not personally seen a lawsuit stemming out of care in the emergency department, but I have seen lawsuits involving primary care and particularly overprescribing pain medication combined with benzodiazepines, muscle relaxants, and then overdoses as a result. Not only lawsuits, but Arizona Medical Board complaints.
So that was going to be my next question, is what have you seen in regards to prescribing too much pain medication? We have access to this pharmacy database, and it's not uncommon to see a prescription for 200, 300 pills from a provider that goes month to month. So you have seen a suit arise because of being prescribed too much pain medication.
Right. And sometimes it's being prescribed not necessarily too much, but if they're opiate naive and they're not used to it, then that may be an issue. There's just all sorts of issues from prescribing narcotics that have come up.
And I think everyone is more sensitive about it today, as you said, because it is such an epidemic. And I think that the Arizona Medical Board is becoming much more sensitive and following up more intensely on these issues. I think that in general, we need to be really careful with our documentation. And instead of saying things like patient is a drug seeker, stating what your observations are about their behaviors, their pain levels, as you perceive them, measurable sorts of things, and I know that can be really hard, but I think you're much safer to do that than you are to make statements like drug seeker in a medical record. I would encourage you not to use those terms.
What term would you recommend if we have that? Malingering is one of the psychiatric terms we were taught, and I was taught never to actually put that in a chart, because even though it's a psychiatric term, it has big connotations. What would you recommend saying about a person who we think is seeking narcotics primarily?
Yeah, I would avoid that term as well. I would rather see you document the observations that you make, signs of pain that the patient has or doesn't have.
And also subjective statements by the patient. I need some pain medication. I've been taking this medication, naming a medication for X amount of time, can you give me some pain medication? Use quotations. If they become tearful, put that down in the record as well.
Okay. So it's often difficult for us to decide in the emergency department if someone has real disease or if they're just exhibiting the narcotic-seeking behavior. So we hope that we always get it right, but sometimes we miss some.
Well, I think that that's one of your biggest challenges in the emergency department. And again, I would recommend that you try to let the emotions to the wayside and try not to let your emotions cloud your need to be able to fairly evaluate and treat the patient on each and every visit. And I know that that's probably much easier said than done. And give each patient that fair shot to be evaluated and to treated.
What happens to us if we end up in that situation and we have a medical record that says this patient has had multiple emergency department visits, his workups are negative, I've spoken with his primary care physician who has also observed multiple visits, and I don't believe this patient needs to be admitted for their pain or treated with outpatient narcotics, and they come back with a bad experience? What position does that put you in as risk management in the defense of the case?
Well, in defense of a medical malpractice case, the physician is not expected to be perfect. What they are expected to do is to perform as another reasonable physician in the same specialty under the same circumstances. So I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind. That's what the standard of care is all about.
One last question is, in this day of patient satisfaction scores, where Medicare is actually going to be based on how our patient satisfaction is, it can be difficult. We'll get one email from a senior member of the network or of our department that says, remember, this is our prescription medication
refill policy that we won't do it for narcotic pain medicine. And the next email, a few minutes after, will say, make sure that your patients are satisfied, you meet all their needs and have everything set. Obviously not an easy place, but do you have any recommendations of what we could do for a patient that's angry that they're not getting their medications that they've requested, from a risk management perspective and also for trying to explain to the patient the gravity of the epidemic that we're in?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to try to keep the emotions out of it so it doesn't become a power struggle between the patient and physician. I don't think that anyone wins in that kind of a circumstance, neither the physician or the patient. So primarily starting off with that, secondarily explaining to the patient what your concerns are and that perhaps you're going to give them a small prescription, but you want to take their best interest into heart and you don't want to put them into a position where they could become addicted or have a greater problem because of the pain medications, and try to help them see that you are trying to be there to help them and not fighting against them. I think those are probably my biggest suggestions. Also, if you have the ability to get into the state database to check their prescription patterns, I think that that's also helpful. And you could even review that with the patient, let them know that you are aware of what their patterns are, and without saying it, you know, let them know that you are aware, and try to avoid the use of words like malingering or drug-seeking behaviors.
So it sounds like if a patient comes in and they have abdominal pain and we suspect them of drug-seeking behavior, their diagnosis should be abdominal pain.
Absolutely.
And you can explain to them that prescribing pain medications for abdominal pain might mask something more serious.
When it's very rare, but when we do have patients that are escalating for different reasons, we try to talk them down occasionally, maybe once or twice in 6 years I've seen security have to be involved. We'd like to avoid have that happen. Yeah. We'd like to avoid have that happen. But at what point do you feel that you would like to be contacted from risk management if we're having a patient that's escalating because of a pain medicine related issue?
Well, first and foremost, I want you to always know that you can call security, that we do not want anyone to get injured, and we take that very seriously. So don't hesitate to ever call security. Hopefully it won't escalate to that point. Possibly even prior to that, after you give your explanations, if you find that there's a particular problem, you might want to excuse yourself and have someone else, like the social worker or a nurse, go into the room to try to further that explanation. I find myself as a nurse, when I've said to patients in the past, I'm a nurse and I want to help you, that sometimes will de-escalate the issue.
So it sounds like, in summary, we need to be level-headed and objective. We need to do a thorough workup of the patient and make sure that we've ruled out all serious medical causes for our duty to the patient, and make sure that if we're still having escalation outside of that, that we involve you guys. And I know that you're on call 24 hours and I've bothered you a couple times already and felt very grateful for it. So,
right, we never mind a phone call. And just to remind everyone, the easiest way to reach us is by going through either the hospital operator or physician's resources and ask for the legal risk manager on call, and we are available 24/7. Other instances of when you should call us are if you think that there's been a bad outcome, pick up the phone immediately. We really appreciate that heads up. Even if you're not sure that something is going to evolve from it, call us. We'd like to discuss the facts with you at the time when it's fresh in your mind, so we can record all the information in our database. So if something does come up down the road, we'll have that information while it was fresh. Also, if you ever get served with legal papers, and I think that that's a more common event in the emergency department than in other departments, because not only could you be served with a medical malpractice legal document, but a subpoena to provide testimony or a notice of claim or a lawsuit, but you may also more frequently get a subpoena from the Pima County Attorney's Office to testify in a legal matter, a patient who was in the emergency department because they were a victim of a crime or a child abuse case, those sorts of things, please give us a call right away. We are happy to help you walk through that process. We have an attorney on staff who can counsel you, who can be with you during the process. So definitely contact us as soon as you're served.
Well, thank you both so much. It's very nice to know that some of the things that we've been doing, we can continue doing. Some of the things that maybe we could tweak a little bit to make life easier on ourselves. So thank you both for your help and your advice.
Thank
you're
you.
Welcome. Thanks.
Well, that's the end of the month. I hope you guys enjoyed everything we had to talk about. We tried to get it back up to an hour because people complained it was too short again. Too long, too short. You guys sound like surgeons. So next month, we're going to be talking more farm cool stuff with Chris Edwards and Jared. We're also going to do a little bit of in-service review, and that means I have to get this out before the end service, which is at the end of February. I'll do a much better job. We're not going to do an intensive review by any means, but we're going to cover those little things that always end up on the exam, like ciguatera, scromboid, weird crap that hopefully we never see. Anyway, until next month, hope you guys have a good one, and please keep your ideas flowing for stuff you'd like, because that's really what makes this podcast any good at all. Take care.